Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. In a world where action movies are constantly exploding at the box office, our heroes take on the monumental task of dissecting and analyzing all aspects of action movies to truly understand what it takes to make a great action film. Ben Bateman, Andrew Guy, in a Popcorn Talk Network exclusive, this is Action Movie Anatomy.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy. I'm your host, Ben Bateman, and this is Action Movie Anatomy on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking movies and all things movie related. We have a really, really, really special show
today. It's a pretty exciting day.
This is insane. By the way, this is Andrew Guy, everybody.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm here. I'm excited. This is one of my favorite movies of all time.
You're wearing a tie today, Andrew.
I'm wearing a tie, a suit, a tie clip, yeah. Socks.
You look sharp.
It's a good day.
You look sharp. This is like another face-off episode, but we digress. We have two ridiculously special guests in-house today. Andrew mentioned we're doing Warrior, one of the favorite movies of all time of this podcast.
Absolutely.
We have the writer and the director of the movie in-house.
Holy shit!
This is insane! We have Gavin O'Connor and Anthony Debakis. Round of applause, everybody.
Yo, do this.
Yeah. Can't clap, no, I'm not clapping for us.
Yeah, don't clap for yourselves. It's no class, you guys.
Very aggressive opening. Very aggressive opening to the show.
Andrew. There's no clapping for that.
I'll clap for that aggressive opening, like that, the whole voiceover thing. And now I know how to pronounce Andrew's name, so we got that.
Oh, perfect. We've been friends for a while. It's not a big deal.
You didn't know the explosion was coming.
Like G-H-A-I.
Yeah.
Go a lot of ways with it.
Oh, man. The football announcers in my high school, when I would make tackles, they would always pronounce it Andrew Gay.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's where I was getting at.
So then my 5'1" Korean mom goes up to the booth. She's like, it's Guy, get it right. Like, freaking out on him. So.
Still writing it on your Facebook page to this day.
Yeah, there
for
she
all
is.
The world to see. Guys, this is Action Movie Anatomy. We talk about action movies on this show. The movies we do tend to adhere to four basic rules. Aside from being made after 1981, rule number one, the hero always plays by their own rules. And this is an odd one because it sort of has a hero and a villain, and it sort of has two heroes.
It's got a hero, yeah, it's got two heroes, a hero and an anti-hero, a hero and a villain, and they both play by their own rules.
100%.
100%.
The hero and the villain are always the smartest people in the room, and that can be people, things, beings, aliens, whatever you want them to be, but I would say, yeah, they're the smartest people in the room.
He ripped a door off a tank!
Yeah, he definitely ripped a door off a tank.
Okay, here we go.
Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, or political figure, or we added mercenary to this category.
Right.
But,
just because we like to watch people kill each other.
Yeah, but I mean, he ripped the door off a tank. He's in the military, right?
Absolutely, he was.
And at least one explosion. You do see an explosion in the background of the video.
We do. We saw it.
I mean, there's reaching. By the way, they reached on every one of those four things.
We've been doing a little bit of reaching on the show.
Should we be here?
This false pretense.
It's breaking form in the show. We don't actually qualify for any of their categories here.
Look, we tricked them into being here, and the door is locked.
If you knew in the live chats when we do this show, like we talk about this movie, how many times the conversation just immediately becomes how much like the fans love Warrior. They just ignore the episode we're on. They're like, we don't like Face Off. Just talk about Warrior some more. So this is just a monumental day. So it had to fit the rules. But
that's right.
What we do here is we usually start the show off with something called thesis statement, and this is a. This is a bold statement, something that's usually rooted in kind of hyperbole that Andrew and I come up with about the movie. We defend it throughout the show, and that's what we started out with. So we're going to check out the trailer really quickly.
Great,
throw it up on the screen.
Can we talk about how we hated the trailer?
You don't like the trailer?
The trailer is abysmal. The marketing of this film is terrible.
I mean, yeah, and we're going to get to that when we talk about the box office.
This is the biggest display of marketing you can have.
Oh, this trailer, to me...
That guy, by the way, sunk the movie.
Oh, dude.
The guy is like
every
J.J.
time
Rose.
He's on there, like, what is he doing? He's killing
this
it.
This trailer gets me fired up, and maybe because I've seen the movie, but...
Just only because you've seen the movie.
I love it.
So, you're saying that this trailer did a huge disjustice to the movie, or injustice to the movie, based off if you hadn't seen it?
No question. First of all, it tells you that everything.
Right?
Yeah, right, and they admit that their brother's in the trailer.
And it's also more like it's not an original trailer. It just is very by the numbers... I don't know.
Well, in 2011, I went and saw this movie like opening weekend with my buddies.
I did not.
Because we were huge Tom Hardy fans from Inception and from Bronson and all that.
We got held for a year. We shot it. We were ready to come out, and then The Fighter was coming out, so they held the movie for a year. So I guess Tommy started to
get a little bigger after
that.
Which is probably better because The Fighter was such huge Oscar bait. That it would have.
Yeah, the studio ran from that. They didn't want to compete with The Fighter. There's this big
tournament.
See, I just adore this trailer. I couldn't disagree with you more.
Oh, man. All right.
Yeah, I love this trailer.
Yeah. I'm going to need a
trainer. I think you guys are looking at it retrospectively.
I mean, totally, because I know what it all is, but...
We have a slight bias for this film.
You're like, I like this film. Oh, I like that scene.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't seen this in years.
Yeah, neither have I.
I was so surprised when you said you hadn't watched the movie recently.
I haven't watched the movie since the premiere.
Is that normal for you? You don't watch your movies after they come out?
Yeah. I mean, I've watched it, you know, 5,000 times.
Right.
Right. Editing it. So once it's finished, it's out of the oven.
So it's not because of, like, you don't like to watch what you've done. It's because you've done it so many times. You've seen it so many times. Because, like, when I perform personally, I hate watching. It's hard for me to even watch myself do the show.
Yeah.
Let alone when I'm actually performing, it's too much.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, and maybe it's the same with performing. I'll see all the warts on it.
Right.
So I don't even want to put myself through that.
I completely understand that, man.
All right, give away the ending.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, by the way,
that part I don't like is that you see them fighting because
the other thing is it's a Cain and Abel story, and the texture of the relationships and the sort of the Cassavetes kitchen sink drama elements of the movie were it doesn't feel like a popcorn film and not an art film,
right.
We were making an art film, which goes back to the marketing. It was, you know, they released it like a popcorn film and marketed it like a popcorn film. And when the movie came out, you may have known who Tom Hardy was, but most of the people in the country had no idea who Tom was.
Right.
And if you ask my mom, your mom, neighbors, people, no one knew who these guys were, Joel was.
Yeah, I've seen people in the middle America today with Tom Hardy. They don't know Tom Hardy.
Right.
So they released it in a wide release. And, you know, we had a lot of, you know, battles about the marketing plan because I kept comparing it to, not that I think it's as good a film as... I'm drawing a blank on the movie.
Which one?
The Indian film.
Slumdog?
Yeah, Slumdog Millionaire. Okay, yeah. I kept comparing it to Slumdog Millionaire, just in regard to the marketing plan that Fox Searchlight utilized, which was a very slow, platformed release, and trust that we'll get good reviews, and let it be a slow build, because I knew that if we released it wide... If we didn't do well in the first weekend, it was over because I knew how much money they had for P&A, and it was like, you guys don't have any money to spend if we don't have a good opening weekend. And they're like, no, 2,000 screens, it's going to be great. It's like, I don't think it's really going to be that great, but...
Yeah, I'd just seen Animal Kingdom as well. Did you guys see that before casting Egerton? Did that play into it at all?
No, because once again, that was done because the movie came out a year later. I think he actually shot our film before Animal Kingdom.
He did, yeah. We didn't see Animal Kingdom with Joel. That was a fluke. Remember he just came up to the house that day?
Well, he had...
You saw Henry V on video.
Henry IV.
Yeah, Henry IV, yeah.
Yeah, but he had also read. Remember the cast it?
Right. Yeah,
so
yeah,
we
yeah.
had seen him on the cast it site, and he did... I don't remember what scenes, but a couple of scenes from the film, and
it was hard. We couldn't find anybody.
The ingredients that we were looking for the role. We met hundreds of actors came through the door. It was a long process because we wanted unknowns, and Joel. The thing about Brendan was when you meet him, you needed to get a sense that he had integrity. He was a good family man. He was living in his higher self. But you also, and Joel has all those qualities, but you also needed to look deeper and go, oh, I could buy that this guy was a barroom brawler when he was younger. Right. That dichotomy was really important for the role, and it was hard to find that contrast with a lot of the actors.
I mean, it knocks out of the park with him. We, you know, later in the show, we're going to do our recast segment that we told you about. And trying to think of older actors that you don't, because I didn't know Joel Edgerton when I saw this movie. So now my perception of him is so formed by this character. So thinking about these guys back in the 80s and 90s who could have done that, it was a lot of work to come up with someone. So before we get into sort of where they were in their careers, mm-hmm. we do want to get to thesis statement really quickly. Right. So do you want to go first with yours?
I do. I had two. And I had one that was more about the film, and I had another one that was more about me. And is Ben and I? It's about me. That's really what this show's about. Is about me.
Millennial moment, right? Now.
Yeah, right. So, like, a year plus, like, almost 2 years ago, I went through a pretty rough breakup. And I ended up having to stay on my buddy's couch for a couple months just trying to figure out what the fuck I was going to do with my life. And
who would break up with you?
Yeah, right?
That's outrageous. Come on. Such a handsome kid. Look, this is on TV, too.
This
right?
is, yeah, it is.
No. Look at the face. Look ladies. At the guy's even got style for
like, I got 150 Twitter followers, okay? So what happened was I all I did was drink every day. I had nothing other than just drink and go to work. And I would sit on Ben's couch every single night. And I would watch Warrior every single night. And this is true. Every day, Monday through Sunday, no matter what, I was drinking and I was watching Warrior. And it was the only way that I could seem to... It was, like, the only thing that, like, picked me up in my life. So my thesis statement is, even though this isn't my favorite movie of all time, it's close. This movie had more of an impact on my life than any other film I've watched, even more than Gladiator.
Which is saying something.
So saying a lot.
The beauty of the story that you told about is that when I met Anthony, happenstance weird story, when I was like, this movie that I love, Warrior, and he's like, crazy, I wrote that movie.
That's a good story.
Yeah,
that's
a great story. And I was like, my best friend spent 2 months on my couch going through a breakup watching it every night. You have to meet him. That was like the whole story. So
first time I met Anthony, he was like, oh, you're the guy.
Yeah. Well, it's nice because Gav actually called me originally to see if I wanted to do the movie, and he's like, I got this great idea for this movie. It'll be perfect for lovesick 20-somethings. And I was like, I'm in. What is it? Like, tell me all about it. So I'm glad we hit the target there.
Definitely hit the mark. Yeah, so okay, so that's, is that the thesis?
That's mine. That is mine.
All right, so my thesis is this movie is the greatest use of an outside song in a film of all time. And I'm talking about Today by The National because it's, I don't think I can think of a scene in a movie that I enjoy more than the final 6 minutes of this movie. Like, it's so flawless, and it's 80% of the scene comes from the fact that it's just the best use of a song ever. You can't...
It is incredible.
There's no... I mean, we talk about Boogie Nights a lot.
Yeah, so that's my argument. Not my argument, but the only other one is the drug deal gone bad with the use of... Jesse's Girl.
It's one of the greatest scenes of all time.
Sister Christian and 99 Left of Blues, which is an incredible sequence. And, I mean, rivals it.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't make me feel, like, as emotional as this one does. Mm-hmm. And I've probably watched Warrior 70 or 80 times, and it still gets me every time.
Absolutely.
Even if I just watch the scene. I don't even have to watch the whole movie and get there. I can just watch the scene, and I still get teared up.
Yeah, it's another part in those movies where the music feels like another character in the film, and it's adding so much to it at that moment.
Yeah, which I also had never heard The National before, by the way. That was how I was introduced to the band, was that one scene, and, like, you know, the lyrics, and you're hearing it, and you're like, your dad's absent, and he's, you know, about today, you weren't far away, and all that. So it just really spoke to me when I heard it.
If you're going through a breakup, you should listen to The National. It'll help. It'll be great.
That's the breakup band.
Oh, the best. For sure.
How much work was it when you guys were establishing which National songs to use? Because they used two of them. Were there others you considered, or was it really just like Start a War and About Today were the only ones you wanted to use?
Well, About Today was... We had About Today before we even wrote the movie.
Really? You knew that you
We were writing the movie. Do you remember when the song you played?
You ever gone up Malibu, PCH?
At the PCH, and you had like these 10 songs. You like, check out these, because Anthony was we love music, and he introduces me to music as I try to do the same for him. And he had all these bands and songs, and that was just, we were driving up to PCH to my house, and I heard About Today. I'm like, what?
He immediately rewind.
Was it the studio one or was it the live one? The extended?
No, it was the live one. I'll do credit to my nephew Zach, who was a college DJ at the time. He's the one who keeps me up on. He sends me mixes every month of all new bands. There's so much great music now because it's just been so democratic now. Anybody can make a record. And so that was the white. It was the White Sessions version. It was the version that...
Yeah.
In Paris.
The Paris version.
Which is incredible. And that's at the end of the movie when it continues after it's fading out. That's like that whole version that's not on the studio version. Because actually the studio version of that song is... It's a great song, but it's so much less lively.
It doesn't have a level. It doesn't rise.
Well, what we did was... So when we were writing, you know, once... Then we started writing and I couldn't get the song out of my head. And then, you know, we would play it when we were writing. It was like, this is going to be... You know, once we got to the end of the movie, it was like...
It was obvious that it would be the...
We're going to use this. So that was always the intention, to use this song. But once we started editing the film, I had sat down with my composer and I said, look, you know, like this is the song, but we're going to need to embroider this song now to lift the audience because right. the song just sort of kind of starts to descend. And even instrumentationally, it doesn't, you know, it's pretty simple. So we needed to have my composer now take the song and embroider it in a way that started to work for the scene.
Make you feel like what you wanted to feel at the end of that movie, which is incredibly uplifting.
It was the crest of the wave. We wanted a crest of the wave ending.
We needed, you know, it was almost another, probably another minute or so, you know, longer than the actual original song, if not more.
Yeah, it's pretty long.
The band was amazing. They sent all the stems of the movie. Like, they sent all the stems, okay, so and they let the composer actually work with their own material. And,
gotcha.
And so it was
generous. Well, do you remember we had to screen the movie for Matt?
Yeah, the whole band.
The whole band, yeah. We wanted to use, you know, once it got to the point where, like, we cut the song and Mark was sending us some, we got stems, but Mark was sending us some ideas of how to make this work.
Mark Isham, the composer.
We still needed their permission to use the song.
Right.
So we ended up going to New York to cut because we just wanted to get out of L.A. and get away from the studio. And we were in New York. Anthony and I living in New York. And so we set up a meeting with you know, Matt and the band and then had a screening for them.
Who subsequently become very good friends with you guys.
One of our best friends.
Well, we were releasing some live, and they, I believe Matt introduced the song by saying, this is the best use of our music that's ever happened in a movie. And we, you know, I think he was thanking you guys.
I'd say one of the best things to come out of the movie was our friendship. I mean, the movie, you know, was forever, but we made some incredible relationships came out of that. Some of the best friends from that movie, you know, Joel and Jennifer and Matt and so many people, special group of people.
Bernie. So if you guys are curious or listening about questions you are going to have, we're going to get to like a live chat section later. We actually have Roxy Stryer over here in the live chat that she's working the live chat and she's talking to everybody. Any interesting thoughts over there?
They are loving you guys right now. A lot of tears in the chat just remembering this movie right now.
That's good.
A lot of smiles, but a lot of tears.
So glad I wasn't on my own on that.
They have amazing questions for you guys later, so I'm really excited to get to that.
Okay. I know you have a lot of questions, but later, I mean, I do have one thing I do want to get into. Like a little more detail on what happened with Andrew and the girl.
Okay,
we can get to it later. I'm a little interested, to be honest with you.
Sweat through my suit.
Huh?
Yeah. It's okay. I mean, there's, you know, half of us in this room, you know, didn't make the fantasy playoffs in the fantasy league, and you're on that side of the table, so you guys can do whatever you need to do.
Which is funny, because only one person in this room has won, so that's what's great about it.
All right, Andrew,
we're going to move on to our fist bump.
I'd rather be you.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, Mr. Bronze Medal over here.
Yeah, all right. That's about it.
He's got a few of them.
So fist bump moment is the part of the show where we talk about that moment in a movie, and you're watching the movie, maybe you're by yourself on the couch, and something happens, and you just have this moment where you want to get up and jump around, and just like, anyone else seeing this? Maybe you got your roommate. You need to watch this scene right now.
Call your best friend. Have you fucking seen this movie?
It's just something happens. It makes you feel a certain way. It could be anything. Could be the music. Could be a look from a character. Could be a one-liner. Anything. A touching look between father and son.
There's a lot of that.
Anything
at
all. Yes. And we like to share our fist bump moments. Usually the fans will tweet in or comment with theirs as well. It's tough with movies like this for us because the whole movie is a fist bump moment at this point.
Every
scene in the whole movie. But I came up with a single moment that is my fist bump moment.
I came up with two single moments.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go first.
Yeah, please do. Do you want to just cue the clip while you're talking
about
it?
Yeah, so my first fist bump moment is the Mad Dog Grimes fight.
Yeah.
Because what's wrong, Rock? We're making Polly at home?
Like, you didn't get the reference for
a
year?
I didn't get the reference for so long. I was like, is he talking about... I don't even know how.
We were watching Rocky IV like 2 months ago.
Oh,
he's like,
dude.
I got it.
Like a true Peter Griffin moment in my life. And I always thought that dogs laid eggs. So this moment, I remember sitting in the theater with my buddy Tom, and I leaned over to him after the end of this fight. And I go, as soon as this movie's out on DVD, I'm going to buy it. And I'm going to watch this scene 10 times. Before I even watch the movie again, I'm just going to watch this scene again. And it's just, I don't know, just the juxtaposition of him being all like, oh, yeah, I fought before. And then Mad Dog being such a douchebag.
Yeah.
It's the best.
That's Eric Apple, from a fighter from Orange County.
You don't make the tattoos, or
no? The guy with the tattoos is just a Pittsburgh local. We loved him. Gav took one look at him, and I think I want that guy. Like, and then like the extras you think are interesting looking, you move up. So Gav like moved up, like, put him in the corner.
Oh, speaking of your boy here, I didn't know. So you directed the pilot to The Americans, right?
Yeah.
So I used to cover The Americans for AfterBuzz TV, And we were trying to get him on the show at one point, actually.
Max Hernandez.
Yeah.
Max is one of the coolest cats going.
I just watched...
A really good friend of ours.
Sicario last night. He's in that as well.
I love that film.
Max pops up everywhere. A lot of these guys you'll see pop up everywhere now.
Yeah, well, and like Noah Emmerich, obviously.
Who I put in the Americans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, he's one of the leads.
No, but you put him in the movie. Or in the show.
Yeah, I did the pilot, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, so I convinced him to do it. He was not... Watch that kid. Comprehensive. Here it comes.
Yeah, his directorial debut is in the second season. He was supposed to come on to the interview, but that storm, his schedule got all screwed up, so he couldn't do the interview with us, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can help you. Noah? He directed... He's doing one this season, too.
Yeah.
He's directing.
It's a good show. Really good show.
It's one of the best shows on television.
Yeah.
That's the kid. I love that kid.
Yeah.
That's a real commitment, by the way. You get face tattoos, that's a commitment.
Yeah. I'm going to get this for the part.
Also, like, just like the entire comedy of Fernie being in the scene and us like finally meeting him.
Yeah,
Andrew and I were so excited.
The guy filming
all checks out.
Fernando Chin. He's a wonderful actor and also choreographed all these fights.
Yeah, we have a question about him later on because the fighting in this movie is incredibly accurate and brutal.
Yeah, it's probably one of the best parts of the whole movie is how.
Dab, Apple just got put to sleep.
Oh, I love it. All right, you can cut it, Mark. That is so, so good.
Yeah. That's a fun scene.
It's a total fist bump moment. I mean, it's like, you're a dude. You like watching movies like this. Those are the scenes you hope
for.
That was
my first one. And then my second one, it's not the same as yours, I don't think. It's after the midnight fight.
Oh, yeah.
Because the one thing that you do in this movie incredible is... It's amazing how impactful reactions are and how much people forget that in movies like this.
And they're so good in this
movie.
And they're so good.
Between the principal, between Jennifer Morrison, between Patty Conlon.
Yeah.
At the end of that fight, you're like, he can do it. Like, he can do it. The school teacher can do it.
He did it. He tapped him.
Yeah.
Way to go, Brendan.
For people who are like, love movies, like, wondering like, all different departments, the director's medium completely, but there's a great example of the difference of, like, what's on a page and then what a great director does.
Right.
Like, Gab's masterful at, building and milking emotion with all those cutaways. So I learned a lot, actually, even on the page. I think a little differently on how to, like, move around, even though it's different, much different, more potent visually. Yeah. But even on a page, like, keeping characters alive and then, like, building them so the audience is... They kind of serve as the audience proxy. And that's completely, like, it was that was masterfully, all those moments were built by Gab, almost, like, piece by piece by piece. And I agree, they totally... They just make you care more. Yeah. Especially, like, even the principal, like, who literally is a literal... I'm going to be the only person in America this year to use the word literally correctly. a literal fist pump moment when Kevin Dunn, the principal, gets off the couch when Joel wins, I think, when he beat Koba.
Yeah.
And he's like, he did it. That was all, like...
It's the best.
Yeah, it was just a great idea. The guy was like, all right, we need to do this. I'm like, that sounds good. And then we put a guy, and that's what's great about actors. Like, these guys, they can be the biggest pains in the asses in the world, but then you stick them in an empty house with a green screen.
They do that.
It'll be exciting. And they do it. Jennifer Morrison as well. She's just looking at a blank screen, and she's jumping up and down.
And the editing comes out of the editing.
Yeah. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. I hope you don't mind, because we're going to come back to your fist pump.
Well, right by your fist pump.
With Anthony saying all this, we have a question here that we talk about where... In your movies, like especially Warrior and Miracle, you have this way of making cliches and impactful moments come off so brilliantly and so palatable. And that, like, I went back and I watched Rocky IV recently, and I watched Creed in the theaters. And one thing that I said, I called Ben after I left Creed, and I was like, it was great. It was a really good movie, man. But I didn't feel like I felt at the end of Rocky III and at the end of Rocky IV. When you feel like when you walk out of the theater, you can just conquer the world. Like, you want to go out, you want to box, like, you want to fight, you want to tell everyone about this movie. That's how Warrior makes you feel. Creed didn't make me feel that way. What is it about the way that you direct that makes, like, how do you make these moments sit with people and, like, resonate so much with your audience?
Because Miracle's the same way. Miracle's exactly the same way. And it feels the same way. And obviously sports, it's like, that's a big, I'm wondering the exact same thing.
The challenge, with Miracle, the challenge obviously was when the movie begins, you know how it ends. So that was, you know what's coming.
Right.
So that was daunting to make that work because they know they're just waiting for it. So, but with Warrior, and Anthony and I had these conversations early in the writing of it, was having done that with Miracle, the goal, what I wanted to do, which I think breaks the form, is Rocky, Creed. You know who you're rooting for.
Right.
You're invested in, this is who we're told who we're rooting for. And what I was, like, what I was, I guess, challenging myself as a filmmaker was, like, I want to have two trains running.
Right.
And play with the audience. Like, who are you rooting for?
Right.
Because they're on a collision course, these two guys.
Right.
And you choose. And I hadn't seen that in a film before. And what I learned, you know, like, when I look at, like, Rocky 3, 4, like, those movies honestly don't mean that much to me, but the original Rocky,
right,
is a seminal film for me as a little boy when I saw that film. Whatever it was what I witnessed on the screen touched me in such a deeply profound way that I knew I wanted that. Like, that just, everything about it spoke to me,
right,
in my DNA. And that film, you know, you get older, you realize, oh, well, the movie works because he doesn't win the fight. That's why Rocky works. Because it's a personal victory.
Right? So we put the question out to our fans of who should have won. They say, you know, we wanted to know, like, you know, we got something like 40 or 50 votes. And in the end, 54% of the people that voted said that Tom Hardy should have won in the end. Yeah. They would have rather seen Tom Hardy.
Really?
Yeah.
The lesson of, for me, for Rocky was, what's the personal victory? That's what the movie's about. It's a personal victory. And the movie would never have... I mean, you know, people can say that, and I appreciate that, but they're wrong.
Yeah. I agree, man.
Because Tommy's personal victory was losing.
Right.
He had to lose to win.
Yeah.
Tommy needed... You know, Tommy was a spiritually bankrupt man. He was someone who was godless. Tommy needed to tap out. Tommy needed to die at the hands of his brother to be reborn. We're getting all spiritual about it, but that's what the character was. So if Tommy won, it's a false ending.
Right. Yeah.
So that was a trick, which we were always like, how do we, you know, how we gave Tommy the personal victory by losing and Joel both the personal victory by winning and also that victory saved his family.
Saved his family. Yeah. So speaking of him losing, I'm gonna jump back to the fist pump moment. So the final sequence, which it's hard to imagine wouldn't be my fist pump moment because it's like my favorite scene ever.
Yeah.
It's the moment when they go back into the ring and it's after already Hardy's had his moment in the corner where he's literally got no one in his corner, his arm's broken and he's crying and Nolte's standing there looking at him and he looks over at him. And Nolte gives him the look, and he looks back, and then he looks again, and he gives him the nod.
Joel.
Nolte gives Joel the nod.
Yeah.
And he gives him the nod, and it's like this, I love you, you're both my sons, I give you permission to do this.
Yeah,
you know you need to do this. Yeah, and he gives him the nod, and he looks, and Joel looks so broken in his face when he gets the nod.
So good.
I mean, there's so many subtle moments in that scene that I just, I love also the
scene.
The
glove drop.
Yeah.
What are you doing, Tommy?
Yeah. But that, the one look from Nolte, the second one where he gives the nod, is I think my single favorite moment in the whole movie. That's my fist pump.
So that moment,
yeah,
we were shooting, you know, we had wrapped Nick. He was done with the film.
Mm-hmm.
And he went back to California. And we were shooting, because I covered all of everything outside the cage.
Right.
With him. And I think we finished with him watching his, you know, watching the two brothers, you know, leave the cage and all that. So we covered all that. And maybe like 2 days later, I was shooting that section of the fight. And it's after the fourth round. And Brendan goes back to the cage. And as he's, and I just remember standing there in the monitor. And Joel's walking back to his corner. And I went, oh my God, I'm missing a moment.
Yeah.
I'm missing a moment.
Yeah. So that's an insert.
So I called up Nick. I literally walked off set. I said, I'll be right back. I called Nick. I'm like, hey, man, how you doing? He goes, I just got back home, and it's so good to know. I'm like, well, I actually need you to come back. I need one more shot of you. I need you for – I'll have you done in 15 minutes.
Right, yeah.
I'm two cameras. We'll roll. I'll walk you through what we're going to do. Oh, Jesus. I said, Nick, I really got to get you back here, man. Yeah. I need – it's so funny because that's it.
Yeah,
and he's like, ah. Flew him back next day, shot it, turned around and went home again.
That's it. I love it.
And that's just so important. Yeah.
It's just
so
incredibly important. I mean, because that scene, there's not a lot of talking in that scene. It's just a little bit between the brothers, but really it's mostly just the music and then these reaction shots. And I would say that the scene with Hardy crying in the corner when he looks around and all of a sudden he looks so scared of what's about to happen.
Yeah.
He knows what's about to happen, but then he puts his hand back up. You know, he's got to go back and fight. That little sequence, too, is, like, so close for me.
It's also beautiful. Masa Nobu Takinagi, who shot it, that's a beautifully... Gavin Masa were so close. They would always be huddled up in the corner on set. But that shot is so artful with the bleeding lights. And
yeah.
That's beautiful. It's a beautiful frame. It's a beautiful shot. And I have to point out, I know that people love Tommy.
Yeah.
Tommy's electric in the movie, no question about it. And I know why people sometimes want him to win, because he's a lot of people relate to him because he's, you know, angry and a little more of an outsider.
Absolutely.
Joel's character has more, in a way, even though he's in a bad spot. He has love in his life, and Tommy doesn't. But Joel Edgerton, like, those moments, like, lowering the gloves, like, he comes out for round five, and he's got his hands up by his mouth, and he's just...
His mouth's coming
All those moments, which all the humanity of the movie, all of it, is completely carried by Joel.
Yeah,
and he just inserted those.
Joel allows Tommy to... it's a generous performance by Joel. It allows Tommy to be who he is, and to take the Marlon Brando kind of, like... you know, people love, the girls love Tommy the most,
right,
and the dudes love Tommy the most because Tommy kicks ass. But it was Joel who, like, Joel was the fighter of the two guys,
right?
Like, who could fight. So the way Gav ended up designing, you know, it was almost reverse engineered a little bit because Tommy didn't have the Tommy Hardy didn't have the physical skill set that Joel did, or the martial arts background.
He just
so
was
the
a
fights
killer.
Needed to be designed a certain way, so Tommy couldn't go through all of the.
So he throws one punch, that's why.
Yeah,
it was designed that way. So again, Joel is doing all the physical, even physically as an actor, he's doing all of the physical work
right.
that's being done by Joel. All those fights, all of those sequences, he put in so many more hours, all the emotion in the movie. Like, he's one of my best friends and one of the greatest human beings you'll ever meet, but I always feel like I need to stick up for him a little with Warrior
because people love Hardy.
People always
so
talk about Tommy, and it bums me out, not because Tommy wasn't great, because he was, no question. But just being there with Joel and watching what he did.
He puts Tommy in the position to shine more because of the way he makes himself
agree. We love, well, it's Brando, it's Cool Hand Luke, it's Fast Eddie Felsen, it's Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces, it's... We love the anti-heroes.
Right.
So Tommy's character encapsulated that and was crystallized, where Joel, you know, he was on the side of good.
Right.
He was on the side of doing the right thing. He was on the side of family. Like, and that's just not as sexy.
No.
But I think as a performance, I'm with Anthony. I think what Joel did is, I mean, he astounded me.
Well, they've both gotten the recognition since. I mean, this movie, and we'll get, when we talk about Critical in just a minute, like, it's not like the fact that this movie didn't make a lot of money actually has affected the way people regard it since. I mean, this movie is legendary amongst the people that love it. It's,
I would argue that it's helped. I would argue that its box office failure has helped the legacy of the movie. More people are personally connected to it and feel like they found it. There's a real personal connection to this movie.
What I find with this movie is that... If I tell somebody that I love this movie and they haven't seen it, they're just like, I haven't seen it. But if I tell somebody that I love it and they have seen it, they get almost more excited that I have seen it.
Right.
They want to talk to me
of
about
course.
It. They want to get fired up about it because it's like...
And we've shown a lot of people this movie.
Yeah.
And they are pumped. And they love it.
It's also like the rare movie that I can watch the thrilling sequences and they still feel suspenseful every time I watch it, even though I've seen it as many times as I have. You know what I mean? When those fights are happening, it's shot in such a way that... Even though you know he's gonna get out of it and he's gonna tap him, it's like you're still like, oh my god, is he gonna make it?
Yeah.
Is he gonna get to the next fight? This is so exciting.
Something like that is all about the filmmaking because usually, like a great song or a great movie sequence, everything, you know, lessens in potency more times you see it. And I agree. I have seen. Yeah, I've caught the movie a couple times on TV, and obviously we know what's gonna happen.
Yeah,
but,
it works.
You get pumped up, and that's just when you know who's gonna win a fight.
Yeah.
And you've seen it 20 times, and you're still psyched. That's all that is. That's filmmaking. That's just great eye in filmmaking because there's no reason to feel that way.
So let's talk a little bit about the production development and sort of finding these guys and then just getting the movie made. So if you look at the movies, the three movies credited for these guys right before this movie came out, you got Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy for Hardy, Inception, and Thick as Thieves. And for Edgerton, you've got The Thing, Animal Kingdom, and The Waiting City.
None of those movies had come out.
Right.
They none of them come out when this came out, you're saying?
Yeah, they
none of them come out. And
when we made the movie. Tommy shot Tinker Tailor after he shot. Tommy, after Warrior, Tommy went and did Inception. That's where he had to leave. to go do that.
Yeah, he leaves set
one
day.
And then he did Tinker Tailor after that. So these are movies he actually shot post-Warrior.
Every one of those guys on that list,
held for,
yeah.
All of those directors would at one point call Gavin to get a recommendation or not about Chris Nolan. All of them. They were unknowns. The only thing Tommy had behind him at this point that people were talking about, but when you say people, it's just
people
our little bubble in Hollywood.
Bronson's super indie.
One's seen Bronson. Yeah. The eight people in Hollywood.
It's a great movie, Bronson was at Sundance when we were prepping.
Yeah.
Warrior, like we had already cast Tommy.
Right.
I had never seen Bronson.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So they were like fully unknown. Like you look at these credits, and for as big as these guys have become now, and this is just a few years ago, you think, okay, well, they were sort of making it. The time you guys made this movie, they really were not making it.
They were fully unknowns, and the big decision and the thing that made it a chancy, when Carver's studio wasn't that thrilled about it, was Gav didn't want to use any recognizable actors. I believe the two people that were mentioned were Colin Farrell and Jerry Butler, I remember at one point.
Farrell might have been okay.
Farrell and Butler were the Tommy Brendan of the known world that they wanted, and Gav just felt the movie. The instinct was the movie would have a chance to be great.
Yeah,
and if you didn't know who was,
but that's once again I recently had the opportunity. I've never met Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah,
and I had gotten invited to this Creed, a luncheon with the filmmakers and Stallone and. And I was like, I don't know. But then I went and saw Creed, and I'm like, it was like the night before, and I said, I'm going to go to this thing because I want to meet the filmmaker, and I want to just express to him how much I love Creed. But that goes back to Stallone. I wanted to speak to Stallone about this, and it was great. It was a great it's probably my favorite moment of meeting an actor because Stallone, when he made Rocky, it was such a deeply personal experience for me. So I just wanted to tell him that,
right,
and share that with him, and it goes back to I had actually seen Lords of Flatbush because I loved movies as a kid, so I knew who Stallone was, but 99.9% of the public didn't know who Sylvester Stallone was when Rocky was made, mm-hmm. So it wasn't James Caan,
right,
it wasn't whoever Ryan O'Neill, that's what we kept saying at the studio is like I was always anchoring the movie in Rocky, Rocky, right. And like it worked for them.
It's a good one to anchor with.
So that was the influence of Stallone and Rocky is everywhere in Warrior.
Yeah,
it's everywhere.
Absolutely. I mean, and you guys stuck to your guns a lot in the casting with this, especially with Nolte, who was a neighbor of your guys's. Is that true up in Malibu?
Yeah.
What was it about him that made you guys be like, no? We're sticking with him. We don't care what the studios say. We don't care. He's our boy. Yeah.
We call him the national treasure. We both, Gavin and I both, were huge movie buffs growing up, and McNulty was one of our favorite actors. That's simple. Like, Rich Man Poor, from his first time on network TV, it was a miniseries called Rich Man Poor Man. Even little movies like Cannery Row, which I love. Like, we love McNulty. And normally you do not talk, we never talk like this, we're going to do a project. We rarely would talk like this. But Nolte meant so much to us, and he had become friends with Gav because they were neighbors in Malibu.
He was in Pride and Glory, so we went down the road together.
Oh, that's right.
Right, right. Gav had to recast him in Pride and Glory, that's right. But we wanted to, the only time we've ever said this, we're like, we wanted to get an Oscar for one of our favorite actors.
And it's an incredible, it's an incredible role. So when you're watching that, and he's on camera, and he's doing this, did you really feel like you were seeing more than you expected? Like, you knew going into it, you're like, this is an Oscar role. This is an Oscar bait role. He's talented enough to do this. So if he does this right, this is going to be and it was everything you thought?
I try not to think about Oscar, stuff like that. It was just like, he just was so, when we started talking about the character, it was just always Nick. So, we would go over to Nick's house and we offered Nick the part before the part was even written,
right?
Before we even got the studio to approve that Nick was playing the part, and then
which they never did. We just ran out the clock. Eventually, the movie started.
Well, the movie's starting, and we don't have anybody.
We used to go up to Lionsgate, and they would have somebody would come in with a folder of headshots, and it would be You know, we would sit there and they would fill a whole table of everybody you would expect who's around that age. Billy Bob Thornton, Kevin Costner, right. Anybody who had more international value. They just did not want Nolte. And Cal would just be like, oh yeah, let me think about it. He just ran out the clock. Like, just refused to.
He hadn't really been knocking out of the park previous to this movie. He had a few kind of down years.
He hadn't done much.
He wasn't.
He was off the. He was off the reservation.
He's like one of those guys you joked about. Like, did Nick Nolte die?
Nick became famous more for, you know, his shenanigans than
Mugshots.
Yeah, one of the great American actors.
Yeah. But what we were doing simultaneously while that was happening, as we would, you know, entertain the other actors that they were presenting, is we would always go up to Nick's house and we would, because he was, I think, the first person to read the script. We gave
that
it
was
to
the
him.
Famous Nick Nolte lunch at Nick Nolte's house. I can tell a story later. If we have time, I'll tell you a story later that you will just not even. Yeah.
Yeah, that was funny. But so we were working with Nick, doing biographical work, really dissecting the scenes with him, and then he would keep going like, but I don't have the part yet. Like, be like, Nick, I promise you, you're gonna play the role. Like, we're gonna get to your deal. Just
come on,
all these conversations, by the way, took place in a house. I would say maybe half the size of this. We call it the Rock House. Nick lived on an estate in Malibu. One of the most beautiful properties up there. Tons of beautiful main house. And in the back, there were a couple of little spots. And one was called the Rock House, which was made out of rocks and had nothing in it. And Nick was always getting banned by the... Well, is he still married to Clyde? I guess. Married to whoever...
He is.
He just had a baby at the time, and Nick was constantly getting himself banned from the main house for one misstep or another. Like, it doesn't... So... Every time we go to do a script meeting with Nick, Gavin and I would like really hopefully walk up to the main house, like,
no,
you'll get to hang out in the main house today because it's so beautiful.
The Rock House.
And then the door would open, and Nick's girlfriend or fiance at the time, Clyde, would just see a finger just point towards the Rock House, and the door would just close, and we'd just trudge across the property, and we'd all huddle up with Nick in this tiny thing, and he never had like. We'd all share like one vitamin water.
You'd walk up to
three
him,
straws.
You say, Nick, the Rock House again. He'd say, come on, guys, I'm gonna try. And you're like, drowning here.
And he would make us lunch. Or there's a sister, well, hey, Nick really wants to make you lunch. And it'd be like, Gavin, are we getting ready to leave? I'm like, we should eat, right? Like, what does lunch at Nolte's even look like? Is he really gonna give us lunch? And I was like, no, it means a lot to him, apparently. Yeah. So we should not eat. I'm like, oh, yeah. We go down there working on the script, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 4:30. I'm
fucking
Gavin
starving.
I'm gonna chew my forearm off now. Like, so finally, Gavin goes, so Nick, how about a. I heard there's a rumor going around. Are you getting lunch? You got lunch? And Nick, now you could probably. Opens the door, tells us to follow him.
Yeah.
We go walk, run across the property. He just had knee surgery, so he's hobbling across the property. He's wearing that ridiculous all white, I don't know, sweatsuit or whatever.
Moo-moo.
Whatever you want. Moo-moo / sweatsuit / is it white or is it just discolored? I don't know. So we get to the edge of the property, and there's a sprinkler going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and Nolte's like lined up like a sprinter at the edge of the property.
You gotta get the timing.
And
just
he waits
right.
Till the thing goes, and he goes hobbling across the grass. And Gavin and I are just standing there famished, going, "What's happening here?" He runs across the property, reaches into a bush, grabs two items. And then runs back across the lawn, this time having no caring whether there's sprinklers or not. So why he waited in the first place, I have no idea. He gets drenched, and he comes back, and he presents us with two heirloom tomatoes the size of, like, racquetballs. Yeah. And he just hands it to us.
Well, that's lunch.
That was
that's
lunch at Nick Nolte's house.
Did you eat a raw tomato?
I've never eaten a tomato in my life.
Yeah.
And
really?
I did eat it.
Yeah.
Because I was so hungry.
Was it good?
I did eat it.
Was it delicious?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I just wanted it.
Well,
I
he grows something. Fruits and vegetables. Like, that's his, that's
quite
his thing.
Quite the gardener.
That would happen every day with Nick was a verb. Something like that would happen.
Yeah.
He was the most entertaining individual I've ever spent.
It was just a normal day for Nick.
He has a lot of character. I mean, he adds just like a lot of character to, as some of the other actors you mentioned, not that they're not great actors, but there's just a lot of like raw and sort of grizzled integrity to that character that I think some of those other guys might not have brought at that point in their careers.
Well, also the past that the character had,
Nick
didn't have to do a lot of work.
Right.
Yeah.
To understand before the 1,000 days that he was sober, that home was a catastrophe.
Right.
It was they were raised in a violent, toxic home.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get that. The thing about Nolte, that was, when Nick didn't have anything to do with, like, if there were scenes where he kind of really didn't have to do much, it could be brutal. Because he, you know, he would, you know, like, it's action, and then you just hear, and I'm like, cut, I'm like, oh, what? I'm like, Nick, how many movies have you made? Like, you're actually playing your guitar while I'm
on set,
while I'm rolling.
By the way, with a tiny, amplifier box.
It wasn't I didn't hear you say action.
It wasn't a ukulele, it was an electric guitar.
But when he had scenes that were, the meaty, weighty, emotional scenes, he was, like, laser-focused. The scene with Brendan at the house when he shows up, like every take, he would just go sit in the car and he was just like, whoa.
Right.
Knew all his lines.
Never.
I mean, because you just worry, like, at that age. But not only knew all his lines, but like the way to play the scenes, the intention, subtext. Like
he never dropped a line.
He was
that's such a
heartbreaking
scene. For
8 hours, just sat in the car in between takes and just sat there and.
Remember day one in the diner? Our first day on set, 6 o'clock in the morning in Pittsburgh. It's so exciting. It's like my first movie. Going to set because you're always working in these little micro.
Yeah.
Like going to this meeting or that meeting, but you don't see the whole. Like, I was like, oh, we hired a costume designer today. You don't see everybody until the morning of, and then you go and there's 250 people and there's trucks everywhere. You're like, because you remember you were just two guys just sitting in a house,
right?
So it's kind of really. I mean, it's amazing, and really, it's an honor, to, like, see all these people came to in service of your vision, and then they're all taking ownership of it. But the first day, we're at a diner at 6 o'clock in the morning. You don't know what you're going to get out of Nolte. Like,
there's
just no way of knowing, possibly. Like, our greatest hopes were, like, he's going to be Nick Nolte, he's going to kill it. We didn't know. So the first scene was the diner scene with him and Tommy.
Right.
There's two scenes. One's now an outtake. Which still bums me out.
That was a great scene.
Great scene. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. It's my favorite scene in the movie.
You could bang the spoon. One's for Iraq or two for Afghanistan.
That's a great scene. The whole Vietnam story. It's a great scene. But so the first, and you said you'd never seen this before. You know, Gav had made, was it for like fourth or fifth movie at that point. But we did a first take. And Nick knocks it out of the park, really emotional, and the whole crew gave him a standing ovation.
He did,
right?
And
which it was like, you just don't really see that.
It's
a scene that isn't in the movie. It's his character telling. He's trying to connect with Tommy about his war path, what happened in Iraq and or what happened because he doesn't know. He starts sharing about his experience in Vietnam, and it's one of those examples of it's like. One of our favorite scenes in the film, but it didn't service
the bigger picture.
That's a kill your darlings situation. Yeah.
Well, so speaking of, you said it's your first movie. I mean, this really, it's your first major film credit, right? Like, even if you're working on other stuff, I mean, this is the first one. So when you were working on the script and you were in production, did you sort of have a feeling like, I just know what we're doing is really special and this is going to be... No matter how much money this makes, this is going to be a classic. This is not something I'm worried about. Like, I just know what I'm writing here is great.
I don't know. I knew it was good. Yeah, that's a tough question because you're always surrounded. And once you get into the environment, the fun part is when you're just creating with your friend and you're just, like, spitballing ideas and we're having fun. And that's when it's still art.
Right.
You know? Like, we always did, it's not called show art. They call it show business. So eventually you get lucky and, the best day is when you sell something and you get something set up, and that's also the worst day because then the door opens and then all of these people come in and you just have to kind of like protect, it becomes art by committee and everybody's got an opinion and Gab is always really good. I learned a lot. We have very different personality types, so I'm probably more likely to, not to give in, but just like, I'll see everybody else's point of view and maybe I'll give an inch or two. And what I didn't understand then was you give an inch or two in this business and they take the first couple inches, put them away, forget that you gave them that, and then they keep asking. So Gab would be like, Nolte's a good example of that kind of thing. Like, he would dig his feet. I'm not casting stars.
Yeah.
I'm not casting Kevin Costner. Like, he would just dig his feet, and there were times where I thought, what's this guy doing? Like, we're going to lose the movie. Like, they're going to pull the plug. But if you don't, then you can have your work completely compromised. So I felt like we were doing something... It felt special.
Yeah.
It felt like it was going to be really good. But I didn't know in the end, I didn't know what happened. The impact that it's had is extremely uncommon.
Yeah.
All these, 4 years later to have people come up to you all the time. And not just say, I liked your movie. That was a really good movie. but the way you guys talk about it, which is that's my favorite movie, or that movie means so much to me. It's a deeply, might never make another movie that people have that much of an emotional connection to.
I mean, when I always say, like, as a performer and an actor, like, what I want to do is to be a part of something that affects people. Like, in this business, it's so hard to do that. So much of it is money driven. To be a part of a project that actually affects and changes people's lives, I think, is the greatest gift that you can get as a filmmaker, as an actor.
So nothing else to do. That's the only reason we're here, and you get lucky if you get lucky to do it. But that's should be the only reason you're even involved in this business.
Well, we always talk about, you know, you live in LA, right? And so you see people all the time, and the more sort of you're around the business, the more famous people and impactful individuals in the creative world you actually meet. And I always say, it's like the show me an A-lister, if I don't care, I don't care, right? Like, I might think they're a great actor, I might like their movies, but show me a C-lister who was in my favorite TV show that I've watched 100 episodes of, I won't be able to keep my mouth shut. You know what I mean? I have to say something at that point. So it really does come down to, if you have that deep personal connection to something, it's such a different experience than just a movie being great and you knowing it was great. You know what I mean? There's movies that are great I never want to watch again.
Absolutely.
Just because I didn't connect to them. We should continue moving through so we can get to the stuff at the end of the show. So let's talk about just like The Critical really quickly. You know, this movie didn't make as much money, obviously, as with the budget and everything, as probably people in the studios and yourselves were hoping. Do you think that some of that came from the fact that you chose MMA instead of boxing? Do you think like maybe the familiarity with MMA in our country at the time just wasn't as wide as the studio was hoping?
Right.
That's a legitimate question. Yeah. I always blamed it more on marketing. I mean, we always, I mean, you know, the easiest thing to do is to blame it on marketing and the fact that they put the movie out on September 9th.
Right.
Which, if you Google September 9th, there is actually an article that comes up that says why September 9th is the worst date traditionally in movie. It's the worst release date historically in the history of the movies.
Yeah.
Weekend after Labor Day. So there are a lot of factors, but I think that's a really smart question, and seeing how well that a lot of boxing movies do maybe it wins a lot of or gets nominated for a lot of Oscars if it wasn't MMA. That's a good question.
Yeah, because the other part
about that, because it remains fringy.
I never did either. I mean, we had a passion for the sport, and it just, you know, the idea of making it a boxing
one.
What's that?
We became
fans after the movie. Yeah,
we became committed
to the movie.
I had made a documentary.
I
executive produced a documentary in 2000. That was my introduction to the world.
Mm-hmm.
Called The Smashing Machine, about this guy Mark Specimen Kerr, who was a.
That's a great fighter. Documentary, by the way. If anybody's interested in MMA, The Smashing Machine is the dark side of
MMA.
Yeah,
Mark Kerr is a fascinating character.
Yeah, he was a wrestler at Syracuse and became a phenom in Japan.
He was 1980s Mike Tyson.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
That's what happens to 1980s Mike Tyson.
Right.
Yeah. So that was my introduction to the sport, which was not. This is pre UFC, and then UFC when it was banned here in the country. So I think they had that one fight in Denver. I think was Colorado is the only place they can get. They legalized it for a fight with the UFC.
Oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that.
It's a really legitimate question.
Yeah.
Probably is the answer. Probably.
Well, because the other part of that was that we were wondering about, like, the casting of the actors, and or whether it was both of those things that played a part in it, but... As you guys said,
we made every uncommercial decision we could make.
But we made every uncommercial decision you could make.
By postponing production, I mean, by releasing it, like, your actors were actually stars at that point. Like, they weren't massive. Neither of them were A-listers, but they were big enough to where it was like, I'm going to go see this Tom Hardy Edgerton movie. Like, I wanted to do that. That's what I thought.
Oh, they're massive now.
Yeah.
I mean, Tom Hardy is at this point, he's totally A-list.
But even when this
Edgerton's
movie came out.
Almost A-list, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, huge. So we pulled a couple graphics here. This is what I thought was really interesting. If you look at the IMDb Top 250, which is based entirely on votes, right? Number 143 out of 250 is where this movie ranks. And on Rotten Tomatoes, 82%, 83%, and 92% between critics, all critics, top critics. So those are glowing reviews. So I went through to find the worldwide box office in 2010 and 2012
of the
number 150 movie, which is what Warrior ended up in 2011.
Yeah.
Just to see, like, what are these movies like? You know, are these movies that people regard as classics? It's a joke. Repo Man is number 150.
Does that say Country Strong? Gwyneth Paltrow.
Youth to Country Revolt, music like, movie?
Made 104. That made $20 million worldwide either the year before or the year after Warrior. I mean, it's just a joke when you look at this or the 2012 chart.
Can I point something out really quick?
Yeah.
The fact that a profit is 151.
Yeah.
Beneath some of the titles I'm looking at. whoever's listening, if you haven't seen A Prophet, if you want to have just the greatest night of your life, go rent A Prophet. It's one of the greatest films of the last 20 years.
I think it's the best film of the last decade.
Yeah, really. It's incredible.
You can switch the graphic.
How many times did we see it? We saw it in New York at the Angelica like four times.
Kept going to the theater and watching it.
So here's the 2012. Same thing. Man with the Iron Fists, Headhunters. I mean, most of these ones
this is not the IMDb top.
No.
I thought Country Strong was on the IMDb office. Top. I was mortified.
Box office of the year before and the year after, just to sort of see, like, this is the kind of stuff, if you were just looking at how much money this movie made in its era per year as the 150th highest grossing movie worldwide, it's a complete joke and a travesty.
Absolutely.
It does not, like, it doesn't reflect, the numbers are complete, they're way off, you know what I mean? Like,
re-release it.
Yeah, I thought that was sort of interesting, but...
People would actually go to that movie if you released it now.
Oh, yeah, I'd watch it again. Hell yeah.
If you re-release Warrior.
Well, talking about the IMDb Top 250, I mean, this movie got an 8.2 on IMDb, and being a part of the Top 250, whether you appreciate and respect the list and how it's composed or not, being a part of that list at all has got to be a pretty big honor, right?
I mean, just like, the fans love your movie to a point that it's rated...
And critics, you know?
Yeah. By hundreds of thousands of people that are looking at the list, they all love that movie enough to be giving it, you know, 8s and 9s out of 10.
Yeah, I think it's very cool. I mean, by numerically, it's tied with movies that are in the top 100. I think it's cool.
Yeah,
it's a big deal, man.
So I think we're going to move on to ultimate action scene here really quickly, just because, and really the ultimate action scene in this movie is the Mad Dog Grimes fight. I mean, that's, if you were going to say it, like, it's
so tough, man. The last 40 minutes.
Wait, which fight?
The first fight. I mean, when he kicks his ass in the gym. The one we already showed.
Oh,
but,
Pulse. Yeah,
but I mean, we're going to... Just because I want to ask you guys a
little more. What qualifies as ultimate action scene?
Usually, the ultimate action scene in the movie for us... Now, we don't do it in every show. We used to do it in every show. We started cutting it. Mm-hmm. But it's usually, like, just, for instance, in Mission Impossible 3, it's the trailer shot where he's running on the bridge and the drone flies over and he's thrown into the car.
That's a great shot.
It's just, like, whatever thing you're watching, it's, like, that scene, it's very memorable, you know? And,
okay.
I mean, Fury Road is just one ultimate action scene. But
it's tough, because in this movie, the Cobra fight...
I think tapping Cobra is, for me, that's the one. For him tapping Cobra and then our dear friend Brian Callen's epic announce.
Oh, it's so good.
He's tapped the great Cobra!
Well, it's funny because we usually, that's what the ultimate action scene became, was we would sit there and we'd be like, oh, well, this is my favorite scene. Like, well, this scene is my ultimate action scene. So we ended up debating it. We're not going to do that today, because there's so many good ones. But the one that you're going to show...
Well, we'll show this in a second. The question we want to ask about Fernie really quickly.
Yeah, just, exactly.
Yeah, so the question we had is, like, this movie, it gets a lot of love as being very authentic in the MMA world. You know, it's brutally violent in some senses because MMA is brutally violent. But how did you approach making a movie that... I'm assuming you wanted this to be a movie that kids could watch, like you watched Rocky when you were a kid, and they could get really into the characters and root for them. But how'd you approach making it in sort of a non-Rocky, non-Disney way? Because you needed to be violent enough that's authentic to the world. So you want to sort of toe the line.
Like raw, visceral, but still palatable.
Yeah, you don't want kids not to be able to watch this movie, but you also need it to be authentic. So we were just sort of curious, like, did you guys consider this when you were making it? Or was it entirely just an art film? This was not a fighting movie for kids like Rocky had been.
I never thought about it that way.
No?
No. I mean, the one mandate we had was it had to be PG-13. So
no blood.
Maybe, mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So maybe a lot, you know. And so I remember thinking, okay, like, how am I going to handle these fight scenes? And then I remembered that, like, all the Bourne movies were PG-13. And I started thinking about other films that handled action that were PG-13. And the reality is, we've seen MMA fights where it's a bloodbath.
Right.
And we've seen MMA fights where it's not.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? It's just not going to be a bloodbath. And I'm not a big blood guy anyway, so that wasn't really a big deal.
You didn't need it in this film at all.
So I think there's a lack of... I mean, there's not, you know, Tarantino-esque, Scorsese-esque, you know, geysers of blood going everywhere. I honestly, after that, I never thought about it.
It's a question of, like, in the movie, like, playing within your restrictions, and it can make you more creative.
Right.
You don't... In that world, of course, there's a ton of blood. It's a very masculine world. There's a ton of swearing... You know, you walk into a gym, obviously, there's a lot of swearing, a lot of bleeding, all that stuff goes on. We couldn't show blood, and we got
one F word.
We got one F word.
Yeah.
And we would talk about it. Like, we would talk about when we were going to use it.
It
was like a grenade on the table. Like, we get to use it once. But I've always felt that, like, I feel like with language, I think profanity can be extremely potent when you don't use it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sex, blood, violence, all that stuff, the more you see it, the more it loses its potency.
When he uses it in that scene in the casino, it's like kicking a horse when it's down. It's really, really hard to watch.
That was one of my favorite moments in the movie, because we saved it, and we saved it, and then he threw the grenade at him.
How'd you guys find
it? The other thing I think that we did was just an inherent to realism, and the thing I just kept saying to Fern and Sam was, I don't want Hong Kong style fighting.
Yeah,
that sort of heightened style. So my rule was, anything that we're going to do, you have to show it to me. I want to see it YouTube. I don't care if it's a fight in Pride, a fight in some back alley, you know, like in a bar, like we have. That was someone shot, or it was in a K-1 tournament, whatever it was. I needed to see that it actually happened.
Right. Okay.
I want to see that. I want to know that it actually happened. I want you to, because you can find thousands upon thousands upon thousands of fights. So that was the adherence to that was that was that was the mandate and the marching orders with the fight guys.
Yeah. There's
the
nothing
beginning of designing it.
There's something fantastical about the fights in these. They are all real and just completely believable. I mean, that's got to be a huge thing with Fernie, right?
Koba picks somebody up, and the only one that's even close
is the power slam from Kurt
Power
Angle.
Slam, but that was a famous Rampage Jackson Sakuraba, I don't know, Pride move, and we saw it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the mandate. I was like, no bullshit.
Yeah.
So he uses the F word. He kicks him. He goes and he has his alcoholic night. And Andrew actually posed a really interesting question. Neither of us had thought about
it. Yeah. I was watching it on Monday night and I was like, Anthony, why did you pick Moby Dick? Because it's great. Like the having it in the background, the voiceover is beautiful. Yeah.
Gavin, we were at Laurel Canyon, I think. Gavin was interested in Moby Dick. I think Gavin was interested. You were interested in using Moby Dick for a long time for something, and then we.
No. I had it as a book, and then you said we should use.
We listened to it on tape. Yeah.
On tape.
Fish tape.
I had already had the idea for. I wanted to use Moby Dick as a thematically running through the film, but I had it as he was reading it, and then Anthony's like, no, we got to do it as an, he's listening to audio tapes of Moby Dick, which was a brilliant idea because it's just so much more cinematic.
It connects with the audience. Is there a metaphor? Is there, what's the metaphor?
Like lost at sea?
Yeah, or is it like trying to fight your white whale, capture your white whale, get your family back,
I think everything is in there. I mean,
Ahab, you godless.
I think it's in the hotel scene if you listen to what he says. And the amazing thing about Nolte, that's one of those scenes where clearly as an act director is going to, work with the actor and be like, just let it rip, and I'm going to shoot you, I'm going to cover the hell out of this, and we'll put it together in the cutting room, and it'll be great. Yeah. But Nick, that was all scripted, and I remember talking to Nick before that scene. I'm like, Nick, obviously, this is just, whatever. He didn't change, he just believed, he was really... That script was the Bible to Nolte. I was really impressed. Maybe he's old school, older actor, but it was the Bible. He was honored that we wrote it for him, and he just stuck to the script. And even during that scene, which could have been improv, it wasn't. So all of that stuff, that hits his Ahab and all that. Yeah, I mean, it's all there. We just didn't want to lean on it too much.
Wow.
You got to be careful with that stuff.
Yeah. So
I think it'll work.
Speaking of some interesting questions, we're going to get to the last little interactive bit of the show here with the favorite line and all that, but we do want to open the forum up to the fans because Rox has been kind enough to be in the live chat this whole time. We have a few fan questions. We submitted some Twitter questions, and we're going to pull some special ones. Look at her smiling over there.
Yeah, because she's everyone excited. In here has been so amazing today.
Oh, the first one, though, is a big one.
Yeah, really big, because our producers really wanted to be here today, Kevin Undergaro and Maria Menounos, and they couldn't because they're filming, which you guys understand, but they texted us a question they wanted to ask you. You kind of answered it a little bit, but they said, we want to know how the movie has fared long-term in terms of its ongoing popularity. To us, it was an instant sports classic like Rocky and Karate Kid and still is. Do others feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think...
yeah, at this point.
Think of the reaction that you got. I mean, the kid who made Creed was dying to me. And, McGav doesn't tell the story because he's Gav, but... The reason he went to Creed because Ryan Coogler was obsessed. Warrior was a huge, huge movie to him and a major influence on Creed. And they wanted to meet him. And Stallone as well.
Didn't know that about Ryan when I went there. I just wanted there to pay my respects to Ryan because I just thought he did such a good job. When I met him, then he shared with me it was great. And he started bringing up his writing partner and his wife, and he said, tell Gavin about what me and my brothers do. And they, you know, he was, you know, honestly, I don't really think about the movie.
Yeah.
Because you just move on. And, yeah. You know, I can say that I've never, it was the best artistic experience of my life.
Yeah. Making this movie.
No question. Most personal film working with him. You know, Anthony had never made a movie before. So I fed off Anthony in a lot of ways because, you know, he was watching it for the first time.
Like young blood out there.
Yeah. I remember saying to Anthony, like, cause it started with just two guys, like you said, in a house, in a room, like, you know, creating this thing. And then, and Anthony's so hugely responsible for so much of the script and the dialogue. And, you know, I think that we figured out very early what our talents are. Storytelling talents, mm-hmm. and how we, I think, work really well together, and that was the beginning of that. But I remember saying to Anthony, you know, first I wanted to be with him driving to set the first day, because yeah. starting out with two guys in a house, and then all of a sudden you arrive and there's 200 people and campers and crew and cables and generators,
right?
And he was, and it was like, so I would feed like that,
yeah.
sort of.
I can only imagine.
But and then he was, you know, we did this together. Like, you know, there was, you know, he was rewriting all the time. We would try to go, Anthony, I'm trying this. What do you think of this? Can you write something? And that was, so like, it was, we fed off each other, and it was just, you know, we became very close. And I think there was obviously a lot of things for me personally in my life, and just the, you know, the idea of the movie and creating it, that, and I think the third thing was that because it just happened really fast. We wrote it. It never happened before like this, except for The Accountant, which happened quickly. That's but quick, we wrote the movie, and we were making the movie.
Right.
And usually there's a long gestation. You know, just trying to get a movie made is so hard, but we got it to Lionsgate. They said, go, let's go. And
a good example is the next movie that Gavin and I are doing this time next year together.
Yeah.
It was written... at the same time, was written directly after.
Oh, so we're talking 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
We're
talking 8 years ago, like, you know, 2009. Yeah, but so Sonny and 68, a movie we're going to do coming up, was written at the most about the same time. So yeah. It just goes to show, like, and that's a more common story.
Why
is
you
that you wait 7 or 8 years to get a project made because it's so hard
yeah.
to get movies made.
Why did this happen so fast? What was it about the production that just made it?
So what happened was I initially set it up at New Line.
Right.
That was where we were going to make the movie. Toby Emmerich, I was meeting with him, and he said, what do you want to do next? I just made a movie there. And I started telling him the story about these brothers, and he's like, let's do it. And I set up the movie at New Line. And then when we started going down the road writing it, I think we may have just about. I think we just finished the script. It was a weird confluence, but this is when New Line got folded into Warner Brothers,
right,
and became a part of Warner Brothers proper. And right. Toby called me up and he said, "Look, like Warner Brothers is never. They're basically inheriting everything that New Line had, and everything had to run through the pipeline of Warner Brothers." And he said, "Warner Brothers is never going to make this movie in a million years." So he said, "Get out of here now. Just go with God with the script." He goes, because once they realize that they have this, they're never going to make it, and they're never going to let it go. So he said, just get out of here. And we went around town with it, and you know, people liked the script, but no one would make the movie, except we went over to Lionsgate at one of our meetings, and they had been developing a MMA film. It was called Pitbull, remember?
Yes. Dog fight. Oh, my God, that was an abysmal script. Sorry, whoever wrote that.
I never read it.
It's a terrible job. He did a terrible job.
I never read it, but I walked in and they said, you know, we have this MMA movie. We just got the script and we've been developing it for the last 2 years. And would you want to make this? And I was like, no,
like, but this is 10 times better.
I'll make I didn't even read that. I'm like, I'm not here to do, first of all, no. Like, and we're here for Warrior. So they were like, okay, then, you know, we want to, they were interested in the world.
Right.
And they just greenlit the movie. Like, I walked out of there like, okay, let's make the film. Like,
wow.
We have to budget it and everything. And so,
to answer your question, yes, people often treat it like
a classic.
People treat it like you want to count, like, they treat it like it's an Oscar winning movie. Like,
yeah,
when
yeah.
you run into people, the way people talk about it,
yeah.
it has the reverence of a movie that's just,
yeah.
nobody in that thinks that that movie didn't make any money.
Yeah, well, yeah, we were shocked as well. Yeah, we I couldn't shocked. Believe it.
So, by the way, Shawshank is a similar story.
Yeah,
you go back and look at some box office is just what it is.
Well, it's a different world now too. But so let's try to rapid fire through a few of them, see if we can answer some of these questions quickly.
This is from James Finneran, who wants to know: did anyone in the MMA business give you guys a hard time about doing this movie?
It's our boy James.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, not no, don't make this movie, but they were Dana White and the UFC were deeply unhelpful.
Yeah.
They kept us from using the MGM Grand Arena in Vegas, for example. We had to move it to...
Just to be a pain in the ass?
MGM was the home of the UFC. They wouldn't let us... the movie was originally set in Vegas.
Right.
The tournament. And then we moved it to Atlantic City, which in the end was great anyways. But yeah, they didn't help at all, and they were very anti the movie because if you were going to be involved in the UFC, they want like script approval,
right?
And you'll often find that in the world that you make a movie in, it should be the world that embraces you the most, and a lot of people in that world did. A lot of people didn't,
right?
You know, you go on the underground and go on any thread on the underground when the movie came out. Those kind of fans will just nitpick.
Oh, of course.
Oh, well, this wouldn't happen like that. They'll go so deep. It's like, you know, you ever listen to one of your friends, like you see a movie love, but it has a lawyer in it. They're like, all they do after the movie is talk about how the lawyer scenes weren't authentic.
Right.
You're missing the whole point.
Yeah, you don't talk like that in court. Yeah, but yeah. Still, shut up. Watch
so I would
the movie.
Say yes and no, but yeah, there was they did not allow us to advertise on any UFC events. I would say they were an obstacle. For sure.
Yeah. What else you got, Roxy?
Flickster Farr wants to know, how is the decision made to make Tommy the guy who punches into submission and Brendan the tactically smart one?
I mean, I think we answered that earlier. I mean, it's the battle of the two and the character of the two. You know, like,
it's the Cain and Abel. Like, there's just the whole...
And one actor was was a fighter and one wasn't.
Yeah.
Well, but it was also creatively, like, the thing about Tommy was, I used to say to Tommy, all you want to do is hit the crack pipe. Mm-hmm. You want to hit the crack pipe. When you're a junkie, you want to get high as fast as possible, and your high is knocking the guy out.
Yeah.
So it's a crack pipe. And that's who the character is. So, yes, like you were saying, Anthony, sometimes you're forced to make artistic decisions, and they're the best decisions. Like Dana White not being supportive of the movie, and we have to go to Atlantic City. Once we got to Atlantic City, it's like, this is great. Like,
yeah, way better.
Yeah, it's so much better, you know?
It's just different.
Yeah, so that was right for the character. He should, you know, we corner the characters. One character has to, he may not be better with his fists, he may not be better with his feet, he may not be better with his elbows, but he's got a bigger heart than, you're going to have to kill him.
Yeah.
He's got a bigger heart than anybody else that's going to step in that cage. And the only way he's going to lose is if you fucking kill him.
I love that.
And Tommy was what's the opposite of that? How do we flip that? Well, Tommy goes in and he annihilates. He's a nihilist.
By the way, I think Tommy's first fight is a fist pumper for me.
Oh,
he knocked out Barbosa.
Good,
that's one of my favorites because you haven't seen I love that one.
One punch. He's breaking
Brian's
every rule.
Barbosa has been knocked out.
How did Edgerton and Hardy deal with their injuries on set? Because, I mean, Edgerton tore his MCL, right? And Hardy broke a rib, a finger, and a toe or something like that? Are these guys pretty much stone-cold badasses?
Yeah, I mean, they dealt with it. It was rough. It was rough.
You guys had to halt filming for a little while, right, on Edgerton?
Yeah, and then, you know, when Joel's knee, when he hurt his knee, all the stuff on the, you know, in the corners.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, there's an opportunity to just shoot everything in the corner.
Got it.
And I had a little more time
to
do that.
He was on a stool for 2 weeks.
Just to take advantage of things. He was on a stool for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And we just saw it when he was, you know, all I needed to do was sit and stand.
But he was a lot of other people would have been out with that injury that Joel had.
Yeah.
Tommy had, you know, garden variety. These guys... You know, the difference between when you're making a boxing movie, you got boxing gloves, which are, you know, 14, 16 ounces, and then you could pad them for a movie, mm-hmm. so you could punch someone in the face. You could really fight at close quarters in a boxing movie and capture it all, sweat coming off someone's face. But MMA gloves are only 4 ounces, so they're really just to protect your hands from breaking.
Things hurt.
Yeah. So Gav had these guys fighting at close quarters, because the only way it would look realistic, they had to be right up in each other's faces. So these guys were really, they were hitting each other a lot, just because they had to. Or else it would look like the garbage can and Godfather was like, well, I mean, it had to be really close.
What was that? Yeah.
So it was tough for them, and they got into it. You know, a couple times they got into it because they were
Yeah.
You know? Nobody likes getting punched in the face for the 45th day in a row.
In general, we're getting a lot of questions about what you guys are expecting in the future years to come. So the Clement W. wants to know, having been in the industry for 20-plus years, what are you looking forward to in the next 20 years as a filmmaker? People had mentioned if you guys were looking to do something like a Creed 2 or more documentaries like The Smashing Machine.
Just want to tell good stories.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And personal stories.
Would you ever do something like a Creed 2? Would you ever, if they were to offer and they were to say, no, it's not for you.
Well, I think Ryan should do Creed 2.
Right.
You know, what Ryan did, I really loved that movie. I thought he did an incredible job. I thought he, not easy to take that franchise and make it fresh.
Yeah.
And turn it upside down and find a doorway into it that was really, really unique. And I just think Ryan is really, really talented. So, my God, I mean... I couldn't do it as well as him.
Sure.
Nor should I, and nor would I be interested in.
A Warrior 2 is out of the question.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
We had a lot of those, too.
Warrior 2.
It's just never going to happen. Like the story just completes itself. Mm-hmm. You could make a Warrior 2, but then it's just for money. Like, it's obviously just for money.
Be curious to see how Warrior 2 would fare with how much this movie's loved now, if people would actually see
it. Right, it'd probably make a lot more money than the first one, but it wouldn't be... I don't think the storytelling would be even close.
It would be bad. Honestly, it would be bad.
That's on a knock
to you guys. Go watch the Bollywood Warrior.
Yeah, the Bollywood remake.
Brothers.
Is that what it's called?
I think so.
Yeah, Brothers. Roxy, you want to fire off one or two more?
That's subtle.
Yeah. Serge wants to know, if you guys could go back and change any scene, what would you change and why?
Yeah, and I know what you're going to say.
What am I going to say? I don't know.
You wanted more time for the beach.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yes. You know me better than me. Yeah. The beach scene with the two brothers, that was... We were really fighting. We had a lot to do. We had, like... Yeah, we were up for like 48 hours straight. Remember that time?
One night on the beach with light fading and
because we had shot some other things at night, and then we had to get out to the beach and then had to get the scene done before the sun came up, and it was very difficult to do. We didn't have a lot of time, so that was one where I wish we had more.
That's one of those inside sports ones where we can't stand that scene. Like, I can accept it. That scene, and that's the scene that the actors, that was always the main scene, like when actors would come in and work with each other, was always the beach scene.
Because it's the first time that you see the two of them talk to each other in the whole film.
We both feel like, and people come up to me all the time, they love, that's one of people's favorite scenes in the movie, they love it, I totally get it, but
should have been so much more.
Missed it,
should
have been better, yeah.
All right, Rox, what else powerful. You got, girlfriend?
This is from @dtruck52.
Oh, I know dtruck.
Really? Well, he wants to know, when making the story, was there different directions for characters or alternative endings to the movie that you decided not to use?
I mean, there was no different directions for the characters.
There was different things in the movie. The movie's like, at one point, the movie started and Mech Tommy was fighting illegally in Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
Which is interesting, because that's how Creed starts. Tommy was fighting in the underground in Mexico, and there was a whole kind of maybe 15-minute, on the page at least, opening to the movie.
There was an original opening, too, with him fighting in a cage match in prison?
Prison, yeah.
And that was the original opening?
Oh, yeah, we cut that, too. Yeah, we actually shot that, didn't we?
Well, that was in a prison.
In the prison, yeah, in West Virginia.
Yeah, in the bottom of a...
Yeah, and then we just decided that to just start the movie with...
It didn't work. I mean, when I was shooting it, I realized it didn't work. It was... But that was one of the studio really wanted, like, to open with action and...
Right.
They wanted the prison bar. They wanted the prison bar, salacious, animalistic, everybody hanging out. Like, they wanted that, which would... Yeah, the whole time I was like, I've seen that.
That would have felt like someone else's movie. Like, the way that this movie starts, the immediate relationship with the father and the son and the drinking and the coffee and the sobriety, it's like... This is the movie that we want to see, that I want to see as the fan of this movie.
They wanted they wanted to come out with it, but I think that we did come out with... We did come out... fighting.
Absolutely.
It just did it with in character, not with fists, but with words.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great opening scene. So I think we're gonna move in.
Oh, okay, one more? One last
this
one?
This is just a comment from Brian Hurst, who's been a fan of you guys from day one. This is going back to Anthony's story a little earlier. He says, I don't like fresh tomatoes, but if Nolte hands you food, you eat it. Hell, I'd eat a cat turd.
So, that's a legitimate point.
I feel like you guys lucked out with the tomatoes.
If you went into his back house...
There were cat turds.
There weren't cat turds. Remember the Noah story with the toilet didn't flush in Nolte's house?
I bet he didn't mind.
So say you can go to the bathroom index and come back months later and you might still find what you left.
Whatever me, Nolte, I'm going to say, I know so much about you. Yeah.
Where are your tomatoes?
So let's get into the last little interactive bit of the show. We didn't mention it earlier, guys, but the podcast itself is on Twitter at AMA Podcast. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media.
You can find me at Andrew Guy. And these guys just don't care.
You guys don't have Twitters? No. And Roxy.
You can find me at Roxy Stryer. I looked for you guys forever. No social media?
Zero. That's when you know you've made it.
Yeah.
Just get rid of that shit.
Not one. No Facebook, Instagram.
Oh my God.
So if you guys want to tweet at us about the show or have any questions, comments, whatnot, just let us know. We are going to do a little giveaway at the end of the show, so stay tuned and we'll let you know. But let's get into the last bit of the show. If you guys want to comment, let us know what you're thinking as well. Let us know. This is Favorite Line. So,
yes.
I think you and I might
have... We have the same one. I'm going to let you take it.
Okay.
But why are we here, Brendan? Why are we here?
Because if we can't win the fight, we will throw in the towel. I will get kissed. I will get tested. I will get the kids. We will go home. You don't win the fight. You don't have a home. It's the best shit ever.
It's so good.
It's the best shit ever. I mean, it blows my mind. Like
Frank Grillo makes a cut.
Frank Grillo, oh, man.
Frank Grillo, man.
I would go so far as to say... I think that was probably improv. I think Frankie probably just did that himself.
So good.
I don't know if that was scripted even.
Do you guys have a favorite line?
Might have been scripted. That might have been scripted.
I think that things were scripted and then he went off. I mean, a lot of the stuff in the corners were, once we knew what the intention of what was happening,
right.
Frank knows fighting so well.
Yeah.
And Frank and Joel became so close that a lot of times we would do what was scripted and then, you know, we were writing stuff with Greg Jackson, getting things, and then just letting Frank just go.
Yeah, Greg Jackson, the great trainer, trains, you know, so many Jones, JSP. Well, Holly Holm, that was Greg's game plan that beat Ronda Rousey.
Did I tell you guys my Frank Grillo story?
No.
All right, so we worked at the same bar for a long time together, and I was bartending one day, and he comes in. I'd never met him before, but I was a big Warrior fan. I don't think I'd ever met you either. And he's sitting with some buddies, and he says to me, all right, you know, give me some beer, and I'm like, what do you want? He's like, give me a flight, one of those, you know, four glasses of different beers. And I was like, well, what do you like? He's like, I don't know, just give me some beer. And I was like, all right, well, what don't you like? And he goes, I'll tell you what, don't give me any dirty pussy. And that's it. That was what he said.
I'm having dinner with him tonight, and I couldn't be less surprised by what you just said.
Then he left his credit card, and I ran after him down the street. And I was like, Frank, I was like, here's your card. Huge fan of Warrior, man. Great to meet you. He's like, oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, Ben constantly uses Frank Grillo in his recasts.
Yeah.
Because he just loves him. He's love probably falling in love with him the movie.
So, Frank and Penn, a very unorthodox train.
Oh, yeah. Coming out to Beethoven. I get no music at all, but Beethoven.
Frank,
this is going to join, Ryan. Watch,
yeah.
By the way, that guy is named Sam Sheridan, who has an incredible book called A Fighter's Heart. That I highly recommend to anybody. If you want to talk about a badass, Sam Sheridan went to Harvard and decided to test his own courage and went and lived in Thailand and Brazil and trained with people he never fought before and ended up fighting in Thailand in one of those 5,000-seat Thai halls with everybody smoking and gambling. And the front of the book is him covered in blood. Like, it's a fascinating book.
Oh, that's wow. Sweet. Heart. Yeah. I'll have to check that. What's it called again?
A Fighter's Heart by Sam Sheridan, who is one of the two announcers in the movie, along with our great friend Brian Callen,
who's also... He boxes with my cousin all the time, apparently.
Who has a podcast called The Fighter and the Kid, which is apparently...
Yeah, good guy. Do you guys have a favorite line specifically, or it jumps out at you?
Favorite line.
You guys think for a minute. I'm going to go with mine. It's the same type of thing. It's just Brendan, man. Like, what he says to Tess when they're sitting there, he comes home after getting his ass kicked. But he wins in that first strip club fight. And first of all, Jennifer Morrison is incredible in this.
We love her. She's the ultimate movie wife. Like,
she's the ultimate movie wife.
Jennifer's the ultimate movie wife.
She's like, every guy wants that woman.
Yeah.
But it's when he comes home and he's sitting there and she's like, I don't care what, like, we don't have to have a home, you know, and talking about raising their kids in a house where a father gets beat up. And he goes, we're not giving up our house. It's our home. We're not going backwards. And it's just this moment of, you're watching it in the movie, and I'd already seen it 100 times, obviously, but you're just like, this guy will not be stopped.
Yeah.
And it's just the true, like, human spirit just going and going no matter what. Like you said, you gotta fucking kill this guy if you want him to not be a problem in your life. Because he's gonna go and go until he can't anymore. And just that line completely sums up who Brendan Conlon is.
Right. Yeah, completely.
I'm going to go with probably Frank. I'll go another props to Frank Grillo because I love Frank line readings are great. Yeah. Probably Frank telling Brendan he has a better chance of starting a boy band.
Yeah.
Everybody always likes that line, and Frank is the right guy.
Yeah.
That's what's great about knowing what actors you have. Like we would watch Frank and Joel sit around and talking and stuff. So a lot of those scenes were written, really rewritten after we saw their dynamic, and then
yeah,
that was we knew. Oh well, Frank can deliver a line like that. Some guys can't. That line doesn't work with some actors, but Frank's great.
What about you, Gav?
I don't know. Don't that know. I have a favorite line.
Fair enough.
Look, he wrote the whole thing. Okay.
Yeah,
well, he's responsible for the dialogue in the movie. So I would be happy to find. I don't know that I can identify a line that.
We've seen the movie 100 times, man.
They'll give you a lot. They know way better than you do.
So let's move into hero villain ranking really quickly. Yeah, and we'll kind of speed through this. So what we do every week is. So we rank the hero and the villain on an all-time list for what we do on the show, and then we also rank the movie on the all-time list. So why don't we start with the best to worst and where this movie ranks?
Okay.
Okay. So Andrew can go first. This is pretty remarkable, guys.
You guys did pretty well.
You made Andrew's number two movie.
Number two all-time warrior. Ahead of The Matrix, ahead of Aliens, ahead of The Last Samurai, and right behind Gladiator, which is my favorite movie of all time, hands down. So for me to put this movie there was pretty shocking to me, but you know what? Screw T2 and Aliens and Die Hard. Like, this movie is my action movie. This is the... Because I like dramas more than action anyway. And to have... That's why Gladiator and Warrior are my top two, man. It's perfect for the genre. It's exactly what I'm looking for in a movie. There's great action. There's great acting. It's shot beautifully. There could be... Because they're all Conlins, they could have gone to the fucking pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. But with the way it was written and the way it was shot, I would have loved it. So this movie to me is flawless, and that's why it's my number two.
We did a full, for anybody who's watching who knows our list, we did a full re-ranking for the episode just because there was a bunch of movies that were kind of out of place, so we moved a few things around. So jump over to mine. It almost is in the same spot. I put it at number three only because Point Break is my single favorite movie of all time, and T2 is the greatest action movie ever made. But almost the same, number three. It's a top three movie for both of us.
It's not often that we do a movie on the show where they're both that high.
Not that stoked being behind Keanu Reeves, but...
The original Point Break is just such a classic.
I'm an FBI agent!
It's a very fun movie.
The lists are tough for us because we have to toe the line between greatest and favorite. So it's if I'm ranking on like the all-time impact list, it's a different list and Point Break doesn't go there. But if I'm ranking it somewhere in between the two, and it's an action movie list... Point Break, T2, Aliens, The Matrix.
I think 2 and 3 is very strong. Provided that every week someone doesn't come in and get moved up to the 2 and 3 slot. Yeah. We're going to watch this in 6 months. We're going to be number 19.
Anytime we have a guest, they're the number two movie.
Well, sometimes the movies move around. We get surprised. When I watched Predator, I always loved Predator. It's always been one of my favorite movies. But I always thought of it as this really silly movie. When we watched it this last time, I was like, this is such a better movie than people give it credit for. Because it's Schwarzenegger. But it's got all these great scenes. Like, it's really a badass movie.
Which are the ones you guys agree on? T2?
There's not any that we have in the same place, I don't think, on the list.
There's some irrationally highly placed movies. Like, for instance, I have Live, Die, Repeat, like, way too high. Like, I think that movie's just incredible.
Doug Liman would be very happy that you're calling it by his modified title.
Right? Yeah, I have some really high ones as well. So we're going to hop over to our heroes and villains. We're going to go with the heroes first. And like I said, for the purpose of the show, we always have to have a hero and a villain. We even added Samuel Gerard from The Fugitive to the villains list.
Even though he's not really the villain.
Even though he's not, just like how Brendan and Tommy's not really either of them are the villain in this movie either.
Look who's number one on the other. That's hilarious.
Which one? Who's?
You have
Ben's Doc Holliday.
But Gav and I are doing writing a show right now about Doc Holliday. We're gonna do a TV show.
Kilmer and Tombstone is like just legendary. One of the greats.
It's a fun performance.
Yeah.
So I have Brendan Conlon at number six behind Ellen Ripley, Neo, and Maximus Decimus Meridius. And the reason for that is everything we've talked about in the show. I love the underdog. I love the way he fights. He's unstoppable.
Those numbers don't add up.
We only got three people.
I got empty spots. So technically on my list, he's the number four all time until I get in 2, 3, 4,
right.
And 7 and all that.
Yeah, so I didn't put him quite as high.
He hates the movie.
No, I put him at number 12. But I mean, the guys ahead of him, it's the T-800 from Terminator 2, it's John McClane, John Rambo, Ellen Ripley, Ethan Hunt from
M3. Rambo and Ripley, you gotta feel good about that.
But I like him better than Riggs from Lethal Weapon 1. I think he's better than Riggs. I think he's better than Johnny Utah. He beats Johnny Utah for me. So there you go.
So he beats Johnny Utah, but Point Break beats Warrior.
Yeah.
All right.
I could poke some holes in that.
Let's talk villains.
All right, I got Conlon, Tommy Conlon, Tommy Reardon at 10.
Pretty good.
I originally had him at 2.
How is he a villain?
I had to cut, exactly. He's not a villain. Yeah. But he's you gotta have he's the anti-hero. And he's the guy that I mean, I was sitting there watching this with someone on Monday night. It was the first time they've ever seen it. And going into the last fight, I was like, who do you pick? She's like, I can't. I cannot pick a person to win this fight. I guess the school teacher. I guess the dad because of everything he has going for him, but I want them both to win so badly. And she's like, he's like the jerk, bad, like, kid little brother. I guess he's the bad guy. Because I was trying to explain to her, like, who do I pick? So that's why he ends up where he is. He's on the villains list because we had to put him somewhere. And he's my 10th villain of all time.
Well, and the thing is, as you said, he has to... Sorry, it flips over. You can see the rest of mine here. But he has to die at the hands of his brother to be reborn. So in the movie, he's driven by anger. And so in some sense, he is kind of... He's definitely more of a villain than Brendan.
Totally.
He's more ferocious. Mm-hmm. So, I mean...
He's terrifying.
He's the same spot for me. He's number 10. You know, there's only... Once again, the people ahead of him. It was tough. This is hard because I don't really think of him as a villain.
Yeah, they're not traditional heroes and villains.
But he's such a good character that it's like, I still put him ahead of like Ivan Drago from Rocky IV, even though he's like really a truer villain. But like, there's just a better character. So he's
That'd be
beat
Koba
him.
If we rank Koba.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to move along. We're going to move on to, this is one of our favorite parts of the show. This is what fans interact the most with, and that's the recasting of the movie. We're almost done, guys. We're almost there.
No worries.
So the recast of the movie is where we pick actors from a separate period in time. So this movie was made in 2011, so we pick guys from the 80s and the 90s. Who would play these roles in 1990, 1985? Who would be Patty Conlon, Tommy Conlon, and Brendan Conlon? Who would play them the best?
If this movie had been made, let's say, in 1991, who would have been in the roles? So do you want to go first with your Patty?
Yeah, I'll start off with my Patty. 1996, 97, Gene Hackman. He's
solid.
Haggard.
Very solid.
He's grizzly. He's beautiful.
Yeah.
He's a beautiful man.
So he's grizzled. So I was thinking, I was like, okay, the thing that about Nolte that makes this role so good is that he's... You can see that you would have hated him when he was younger. You can see he was an abusive alcoholic, and he's very grizzled looking. But I went with Paul Newman. I went with like 92 Paul Newman. And I'm talking Newman.
I would have gone Paul Newman.
Was it? You would have? And the reason I do it is because he's so like charming and handsome that if you see him all cleaned up when he's older, you just imagine how abusive and manipulative
how
his handsome, confident,
really
alcoholic father would have been when he was younger. And Newman's just so good that... Yeah, that was mine.
You picked two of the greatest actors of all time.
Yeah, I don't know that I would have gone... And Newman's my favorite actor of all time.
Yeah.
But I think the problem with Newman is that, you know, when you look at a film like HUD, where he tried to play the biggest heel with no redeemable qualities whatsoever, it still didn't work for him.
Right.
Because people still found him...
Something too lovable about him.
Yeah, or charming or likable, even when he was trying to be unlikable.
He has a blue-eyed charm to him that just never goes away.
That's why he's a movie... Yeah. And I think he's the greatest movie actor of all time. I mean, my dream in life would have been to work... Artistically would have been to work with Paul Newman. I mean, he's my favorite, by far.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to say that, but I don't think... I don't see him... I'm with you. I think Hackman... has more of the qualities.
The post Color of Money, Newman, the Color of Money is one of my favorite movies of all time, and like that, he just the scene when he gets beaten by Forrest Whitaker, and he's like, "You showed him your ass," and he's in the pool hall, and I just, I don't know, at that age, he was just so good. I think he could have gotten
even Sully when he played Sully in Nobody's Fool, which was a great role, and sort of a down and out guy. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's no right or wrong in this.
I think we should go Tommy next, and
all
not
right.
Brendan. So who do you have for Tommy Conlon?
So you told me you're Tommy Conlon, and I actually, in the end, I like yours a little better.
Of course you do.
But I still like mine. I still like mine a lot. So I went like a 1994 Mickey Rourke. So after the fall from grace, after he's already he's already sort of out of the limelight, he's already troubled, he's much more angry, much less sexy than he was in like 1989, and that's who I went with Tommy. I think he's still... Because he was boxing, I think, at that point already. He was almost boxing.
Right.
He ended up boxing in the 90s.
You're picking all of our all-time favorite actors.
Rourke? Okay. Yeah.
Rourke's one of Gavin's favorite actors.
80s Rourke, even as far back as Diner, which is, one of my favorite movies.
This might be our...
We could do a whole show.
If you pick one movie that was probably each of our favorites, if you combined it would be Diner.
Yeah,
it was the movie we bonded over when we met. We talked about Diner for hours.
Yeah, I fucking love that. I see Tim Daly around Santa Monica all the time.
Yeah.
Anybody's in that cast gets a...
Yeah, it's crazy. Right. But I think Rourke would have been great. I still think yours is a little better,
though. That's good. Rourke's good. I went with 90s Russell Crowe. L.A. Confidential time, before he did Gladiator, before... Because that's kind of where... Even though that's where more so where Edgerton is in his career at the time that this movie came out. I think because we all know Russell Crowe can be a bad boy and an asshole, and he's big. He can fight, you know. So Tommy Conlon, Russell Crowe, they got the same attitude, same look. I think it'd be good.
Yeah, I love that casting. It's just he had like L.A. Confidential. He's got that rage,
exactly.
And I think you could really use that rage for the character.
Because the looks of rage in Tommy in the Ring are some of the best things. Like when he knocks out Mad Dog in the Ring, it's great.
Yeah.
All right, Brandon Conlon.
So this one, mine's a little funny, but I was thinking about the year. If I went like 1992, I went Nick Cage, 92. And I'm talking before Leaving Las Vegas, when he was still like up and coming, pretty jacked. He was in really good shape. But he did all those movies like It Could Happen to You, where he's like this really nice husband, or he's like a kind of well-to-do guy. He's very sweet. Ticket. Yeah, say what?
The winning ticket, is that what it's called? He like leaves the lottery ticket for the waitress.
That's It Could Happen to You.
Oh, It Could Happen to You, right.
Sandra Bullock?
Yeah, I can't remember who. Yeah, it might be. But, you know, or like he looks so rosy-cheeked and moonstruck. He just had this, like, really young, really nice, but then he did the Vampire's Kiss and all those movies where I know he could put on the size. So I think he would have been a really good Brendan. I think he has the chops before he got so crazy, before everybody was like, Nick Cage is just nuts.
Right. Nick Cage was Sean Penn. I mean, Nick Cage and Sean Penn were routinely mentioned in the same conversation as far as
in the mid-90s.
Up-and-coming actors with integrity from the early 80s on. They were in Racing with the Moon together. They were the same. They were considered the same integrity-wise.
Yeah.
Like, and promise.
Well, Cage has all those movies he did. Rumblefish and like, Wild at Heart.
Arizona.
Raising Arizona. Like, Red Rock West. He did all these movies in the late 80s and 90s that were just great.
Valley Girl, Racing with the Moon. He did a lot. He was a wonderful actor. And
Peggy Sue got married.
He lost it.
Yeah, Peggy Sue. I love that one.
He lost the plot completely.
What do you got?
I'm pretty proud of this because he's a few years older than Russell Crowe, which is the same with Brendan and Tommy. Kevin Costner. At the time.
Yeah.
Like 1990.
Like pre-Dances with Wolves
Like 90.
So like
right around there.
After No Way Out, after Untouchables, but before Dances with Wolves. Okay, yeah.
So where people wanted to see more of him, they liked him, he was about to be that guy. Like we talked about him and Swayze.
Yeah.
And how he was kind of that guy over Swayze at that time.
Right at that time,
like he's a little more star power than these guys, but God, he would have been a good Brendan.
I think your recast is really sound. I think yours beats mine by like... But remember, guys, if you're watching this, you get to vote on Twitter. Hashtag MasteryCaster is the... let us know who
Crow,
wins.
Crow, Costner, I'm Hackman.
Crow, Costner, Hackman, and you're going...
Rourke, Cage, Paul Newman.
Who took it for you, boys? Who's the Master Recaster?
Your recast is better. Yours has two of my three favorite actors of all time.
I can't wrap my head around any of those people.
You're like, that movie sucks.
No. I just,
I'm trying to picture Costner fighting is a little weird.
Yeah, for Brendan or Tommy. Like, the Hackman I get, but the other guys I'm not quite, I'm not really seeing
fair
it.
Enough, fair enough.
How about Ben and Andrew?
Yeah, I'd be Tommy.
You think so? You'd definitely be Tommy.
I'd be the adopted half
brother. Total Tommy. We open the movie. He has just got broken up with.
Yep. I've got my bottle of whiskey.
Why were you just broken up with?
Oh, God.
You were going to get this in worse.
can't get into it.
Yeah, thank you. We've been working with
Lane. She couldn't put up with me anymore. Left.
Her loss in the long run. You're gonna...
we should move on to the last bits here because we're almost out of time.
No Cage versus Cruise. We do a segment on the show where we talk about whether Nick Cage or Tom Cruise were one of the roles. We won't do that.
Yeah, the answer's always going to be Cruise. So.
Yeah.
Not necessary. But we always talk about there's three action movie categories. There's totally legitimate, totally ridiculous, and ridiculously legitimate. So totally ridiculous is Face Off and Con Air. It's movies that don't hold together. They're hilariously bad, but they're awesome in a bad way. There's movies that are totally legitimate. So that's Terminator 2, that's The Matrix, that's The Fugitive. You know, they're true classics. And then there's the middle category, which is ridiculously legitimate. We think of movies like Point Break, The Rock. They're generally rooted in one really strong performance in the middle of kind of an absurd context, but they hold together. They're really compelling the whole time.
I thought you were going to say Point Break for that
category. Predator is that category, totally. Unintentionally funny at times. For me, this movie is no question totally legit.
It's totally legit.
There's 100%. No part of it, because I never laugh unintentionally. There's no part of it that I'm ever like...
No.
This is a little bit of a stretch. It's just,
I only laugh now because I've seen the movie so many times, and I'm like, oh, yeah.
That's... Yeah.
Good line, Frank.
Yeah, good line, Frank. I think that's a pretty easy one. Would you guys agree?
I would hope so, yeah.
Yeah, right. Totally ridiculous.
The other categories are just, we got no room in those categories. Yeah. Anything involves the word ridiculous that you spent years of your life on. You don't really want to end up in that category.
No good. So really quickly, we are going to pitch next week. So before we do, guys, we are going to be signing these two rundowns. We aren't going to be signing them. Gavin and Anthony have offered. They're kind enough to sign these rundowns. We're going to give these away to you, the fans. And to do that, you have to tweet in at us at hashtag AMA podcast. Or I'm sorry, at AMA podcast is the Twitter, but hashtag AMA warrior. Should we put anything else? AMA warrior giveaway, maybe?
Whatever. Who cares? Yeah, AMA warrior, and then just talk about the giveaway. It'd be fine.
No, because AMA warrior was the question. So let's do hashtag AMA warrior giveaway. So hashtag AMA warrior giveaway, and we will be mailing out these two scripts that are signed. Let's see here.
Yeah. Well, they can sign it.
Yeah?
Let's have you guys talk
about it. You should have Roxy hand deliver them, though. You can juice up the
promotion. We will.
You can't see this on film, but she's wearing knee socks, so that's happening right now. Thigh highs, actually.
Thanks for calling me out. Appreciate it.
Thanks for wearing the thigh highs.
Rox, can you toss me that Sharpie that's next to you?
Seriously?
Yeah.
And then what we're going to talk to you guys about. Ben didn't play sports growing up. It's not his fault.
I feel like that was a really good throw, too.
Completely professional performance by Ben till right then.
Cut the show! Yeah. So you guys have two projects coming up that you're working on separately. Obviously, you got The Accountant, which we would love to wrangle you back in for that, and then you're working on Midnight Kush, right? So we want you guys to talk about what you're working on next to let the audience know.
We got
so
a couple things together. I mean,
whatever you guys want to talk about.
Yeah.
Look, I've had The Accountant coming out, and I'm going to talk about The Accountant for a second because I'm so stoked on it. I have nothing to do with The Accountant except I'm a huge fan of The Accountant. Ben Affleck plays an accountant can I say that he has a condition?
Yeah.
He has mild Asperger's. It's a fascinating and really, I think it's the most fun movie you've made. It's really interesting and it's big. Warner Brothers tested so highly that Warner Brothers moved it to October next year for award season. I think it's going to be a huge movie, which probably going to make another one of it. It feels sequel-y.
Really?
Franchise-y more than sequel. It feels like a franchise. It's going to be a huge movie, I think.
More of an action movie than Warrior, you think?
Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's really a sort of a gene splicing of a lot of different genres. It's very much of a character piece. He's a black money accountant. So
right.
He goes in and uncooks the books for whether drug cartels or the mob.
Okay.
But he has Asperger's syndrome, so he has very, very limited social skills. We made sure, and we met a lot of people on the spectrum, high end, and was really attuned to making sure we get that right.
Right, because you don't want to offend people.
No, and I mean, we wanted to make sure that we represent, you know, that the condition in a very honest way. So that was fun and fascinating and really cool. And then there's like a weird love story in there. And then it's a puzzle. It's a very much of a puzzle movie. You really have no idea. It's in like a Usual Suspects kind of way. You really have to. The Rubik's Cube eventually lines up the colors, and then it's an action film. Yeah, it's very much once it kicks into gear.
Yeah,
it takes off.
The cast is nuts, right? It's Anna Kendrick, J.K. Simmons, Ben Affleck. John Lithgow's in it, right?
Yeah.
Just like someone else, at least one other person.
Jeffrey Tambor, right?
Yeah, Jeffrey Tambor's in it. Yeah,
it's Rain Man with guns.
John Bernthal,
you're gonna love it.
Rain Man with guns, I love it. It's amazing. And that's this October. It's coming out
October 7th.
Yeah. There we go. Hell yeah.
Yeah,
it's gonna be great.
You want to talk about your movie?
Yeah, I'm doing a movie called Midnight Kush. It's we're starting shooting next month with Charlize Theron and Joel Edgerton.
Nice.
Boy.
Hell yeah.
Joel's brother Nash is stylish and really cool up and coming directors directing it. Little Fargo.
Nice.
It's about an American businessman who gets kidnapped in Mexico and everything goes sideways.
Cool.
But then Gavin and I together are doing a show. We're doing a show on Doc Holliday.
Oh, sweet.
That we haven't announced yet, but we're working on it right now. And then this time next year, we're doing a movie that we've been trying to do since Warrior called Sonny in 68, which is about a disgraced former professional poker player.
Oh, nice.
Which you two are really going to like that movie. It's
I mean, these all sound great.
Yeah
it's going to be fun.
Is Val Kilmer playing Doc Holliday?
Val Kilmer will not be playing a movie star will be playing Doc Holliday, but we probably shouldn't say who it is yet.
Sure.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, hell yeah, man. I'm excited for all those things coming up.
I can't wait. So why don't we have you guys do the quick signing for the fans here. We'll sign this one and that one. We'll get these mailed out. I'm keeping mine. Anywhere you want.
What's next week's movie? I'll need to tee up your site.
Yeah, go ahead, Bateman. Why don't you pitch it while they're signing these?
Yeah, we saw the trailer for 13 Hours, the new Michael Bay movie, and we thought it looked really sweet, and the reviews are pretty sweet. Like, they look really good. I mean, it's... For Bay, he's missed the mark a few times, and he's an action movie classic director, so I think we're going to hit it. We're gonna make that the movie. So we are... We pitch one. You guys vote on it next week. We are doing 13 Hours. It's Krasinski's in it.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, he looks like he put on a bunch of muscle for it.
Pulled the Bradley Cooper.
Have you seen the movie?
We haven't seen it yet. We're going to watch it this week.
Okay.
I've heard it's really great, though.
It looks pretty cool. I'm into it.
Yeah.
All right, so 13 Hours next week. Michael Bay, that's our bread and butter right there.
That's the one. So if you guys want these rundowns, these signed rundowns, you have to tweet in, and we will randomly select two of you and send them out, just like the mugs that we said we were going to send and never did.
Still coming.
But we will send them.
A lot of talk of that in the chat.
They run a real tight ship here.
Caught in the Panama Canal. Yeah. No problem.
So,
guys, thanks so much. This was so much fun.
Yeah, this was everything that a fanboy of this movie could ever ask for. We got to ask all the questions we wanted. You guys laughed at our jokes.
I hope we kept it together enough.
Yeah.
You guys are great. Yeah. These guys are also, I'm a member of their fantasy football league, I should.
Yes.
I should point out.
They both finished ahead of me this last year, so next year, boys.
You guys could see the email transcripts between these two. The shit talking was pretty much the greatest thing I've ever experienced.
It was aggressive.
Looking forward to next year. It's gonna be great. Thank you so much for coming by,
guys.
Thanks for having us.
See you guys next week for 13 Hours.
Take care, guys.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.